And he said, well, what about Abraham Lincoln? My brain exploded, and I said, well, I said the title of my book, which I won't say here, but it is Abraham fill in the blank Lincoln. Like, who am I to write about Abraham freaking Lincoln is what I'll say here.
That is Sarah Benincasa, comedian, author, and the most unlikely Lincoln biographer you'll ever meet. I'm Jenny Skoog. For 8 months, I followed Sarah and three other biographers through the messy, lonely, and exhilarating work of writing about someone else's life. This is a special 6-episode season, a departure from our traditional format. There will be no formal interviews with established biographers this time. Instead, I'm telling the story of what it actually takes to write biography right now. The archives, the business, the rejection, and the stubborn refusal to quit. This is Four Paths, One Impossible Dream. Episode 1. Who gets to write biography? We have four biographers at different stages. One of them has a book deal. One has just published. Another has been collecting research for years. And one is trying to break into the genre while pregnant with her third child. Ready? Let's go. Somewhere between 15,000 and 18,000 books have been written about Abraham Lincoln since he was murdered in April 1865. Sarah Benincasa is writing number 18,001. She's a stand-up comedian and has never written a biography before.
Oh, yeah, it seems really incongruous. It's quite odd. I started out as a high school teacher. I became a stand-up comedian. I've published 2 books of fiction, 2 books of nonfiction. None of them have been biographies. Even the novels were not even historical fiction.
So, how does a comedian end up writing about one of the most written about figures in American history? Well, it started with sobriety.
I fell in love with audiobooks starting right about when I got sober. So I got sober in about 20, not about, I know the exact date. I got sober in 2018.
With more time on her hands, Sarah started devouring audiobooks, biographies specifically, 19th century ones, and one figure kept pulling her back. She told her agent, Scott Mandel, who's been her agent since her 20s, that she wanted to write a biography of Frederick Law Olmsted, the designer of Central Park. His response?
He said, okay, I love that. I love your passion about that. But why don't we consider someone who, like, that's very clearly a special passion of yours, Sarah, but why don't we consider somebody who may have a little bit of a wider appeal, which is great because an agent should think about those things. And I said, okay. And we're thinking about different ideas. I was like, who could it be? Oh, who could it be? You know? And he said, what about Abraham Lincoln? My brain exploded.
And then she said yes. The book went to auction in February 2025. Grand Central Publishing, an imprint of Hachette, won. Publication date, 2027. So Sarah has everything a writer could want. An agent, a book deal, a deadline, and an editor that she loves. And she's terrified. Because the Lincoln she grew up with, he wasn't a person.
Who was this guy? Because the received Abraham Lincoln, at least the one I received, is not a man. He's a character who I call Saint Abraham of America, which of course he himself would not have used the term America at that time for the United States of America. He might have said the Union or used different phrases. But when I was growing up, I was born in 1980, and when I was growing up, he was almost a cartoon angel.
Sarah wants to turn the cartoon angel into a human being, and she wants to do it for people who would never pick up a traditional history book.
This is my dream. My dream reader is somebody who writes to me and says, I don't like reading about history at all. I think it's boring. But I was at a Hudson Books at the airport or at the train station, and I was bored, and my AirPods wouldn't work. And I was like, how am I going to get through this trip? And I saw your cover. It was so cool. The title seemed kind of wacky. So I bought it, and I loved it. And now I'm buying more historical biographies by other authors.
A gateway drug. That's Sarah's word for what she wants this book to be. Not a replacement for the serious Lincoln scholars, but a doorway to them.
My role model for how Comedy Brain works with History Brain would be there's a few. There's Stephen Fry, there's Sarah Vowell, my friend W. Kamau Bell. There are a few different people who I can look at. I can listen to, watch on TV, or read. I can derive inspiration from all of them. I am very aware that I am a pretty average American without a PhD in history or years of deep, rigorous study in history, writing a historical biography. And I have to be very clear about that. Not that anybody is going, wow, you really seem like a genius. But to be clear about that is like, you're not going to be David Herbert Donald. You're not going to be Doris Kearns Goodwin. You're not going to be Michael Burlingame, these brilliant Lincoln biographers. And I've only named a few. James McPherson, my fave. What a dream his writing is. That's not me. So I can look at other people who I admire just as much, but who are operating in a bit of a different sphere. And so then my expectations for what I'm going to get for them are a bit different. I can look at Vowell and Fry and Bell, and there are others, and go, okay, cool. I'm not copying them, but there is a world, there's a space I can
Of
occupy.
course. But occupying it means going head to head with those thousands of other books. All while working a full-time day job at a nonprofit, maintaining a comedy career, and figuring out how to write something she's never written before. When I first spoke to Sarah in the spring of 2025, she had been reaching out to Lincoln Scholars for help, professional emails with specific questions.
I've mostly gotten ignored and I'm fine with that. Mostly gotten like my emails have almost all, not all, but a lot of them have gone unanswered and that's fine. I don't know if I'd want to talk to me either. They're all busy. They're doing stuff. Who even knows? Who is it, an assistant reading them? Is it them?
She laughed when she said that, but what I heard underneath it was that Sarah Benincasa is writing a biography of Abraham Lincoln, mostly alone, in the margins of a very full life. And the people who know the most about her subject won't return her emails. But we'll come back to Sarah. She's got a long road ahead, and a deadline she doesn't realize she's wrong about. Kate Culkin is a history professor at CUNY, the City University of New York. Her first book was about Harriet Hosmer, a 19th-century American sculptor. Her second book, out in July 2025 from UMass Press, is called Emerson's Daughters: Ellen Tucker Emerson, Edith Emerson Forbes, and Their Family Legacy. Ralph Waldo Emerson's daughters lived in their famous father's shadow and did far more than anyone gave them credit for.
On paper, their lives were very different. Ellen, who was born in 1839, does not get married. She continues to live with her parents, and is really their day-to-day caregiver. And Edith marries William Forbes and moves to Milton. That's part of the Forbes family. She has eight children.
One sister stays and has no children. One sister leaves and builds a large family. And together, they manage their father's legacy, edited his work, supported each other's projects, and built a partnership that history has totally forgot.
It's a story of these two sisters who had very different lives and sometimes fought about that, as people of siblings do, but really supported each other. And I thought that was also particularly important given that their father is so associated with the idea of self-reliance. And so these sisters very much were focused on partnerships and community, and also made the author of Self-Reliance's life possible in many ways in his later years.
I love that. The Self-Reliance guy's daughters were focused on partnership. Kate came to the Emersons through women's history, not through transcendentalism. And she ran into a problem that a lot of biographers face: writing about an experience she has not lived. The thing is, Edith Emerson Forbes had 8 children, but Kate is not a mother.
So I started spending time, like, paying more attention probably than I had in the past about how books handled motherhood, biographies handled motherhood. I found it a little bit frustrating often. I think biographers aren't quite sometimes sure what to say. Like, often biographies are about quite ambitious people. That's why someone's choosing to write a biography about them, because they did something in the public world. And often that means they made choices about how they raised their children or about having children that you could tell the biographers were uncomfortable with it. So sometimes it was like they highlighted, sort of even inadvertently just couldn't get away from language that was judgmental towards the mothers, or just sort of downplayed it.
When I met with Kate in May 2025, her book was 2 months from publication. Or so she thought. The marketing manager had just told her the books were already shipping.
Just this week, I heard from the marketing and sales manager who, she's like, oh, the books are actually here. She's like, I'm sending them out now. I was like, wait, it's May. I thought the book was coming out in July, but my aunt, who I would have, of course, given a copy to, had pre-ordered the book. And she's like, I just got a notice it's being sent. I'm like, oh, okay.
The book was arriving before Kate was ready for it. And nobody had trained her for what comes next. A friend who's a VP of marketing at a trade house gave her advice. Tell bookstores you can bring an audience.
No one trains you in academia about that. And I wouldn't even really thought about it. I was like, oh, yeah, the author has to work to get the audience in. That's the bookstore will do their best.
The author has to work to get the audience in. Kate was learning this in real time, 2 months before pub date, with books already in the mail. But I'm getting ahead of myself. In May 2025, Kate's book existed as a finished object that she hadn't quite held yet. A strange limbo. Years of work behind her, and absolutely no idea what was on the other side of publication. Kevin McRuder teaches at Antioch College in Ohio. He's published 2 books, both about race and real estate in Harlem. He has a PhD and is a serious historian. And he's been thinking about his next subject since 1982.
I moved to New York in 1982. I've been living in Cleveland, and I moved there to enter the MBA program at Columbia Business School. And the first week I was there, I went to a lecture at Hunter College, in which Eric Garber talked about LGBTQ people during the Harlem Renaissance. And I'm gay. I had been out to myself for about 5 years at that point and was still kind of trying to figure out, well, where does a Black gay man fit into this culture?
His first week in New York and Kevin's world cracked open. He went to business school and became a community development lender, making loans to community development corporations during the day. But at night, he was reading everything he could about the Harlem Renaissance. And one name kept popping up: Rudolph Fischer.
So Rudolph Fischer was born in 1897. He's not as well known as the other Harlem Renaissance folks, but he was in the inner circle of Langston Hughes, Erna Hurston. He was friends with them all. He wrote 2 novels, about 15 short stories, and at least 1 essay. He died in 1934.
He was just 37 years old. And Fischer wasn't just a writer. He was a radiologist, a physician with a dual career, writing fiction at night the same way Kevin was researching.
He was friends with all of them. They all liked him. Some of them didn't like each other, but they liked him.
Everybody liked Rudolf Fischer. But after he died, something happened. Or rather, didn't happen. Nobody wrote a full biography. One scholar, Calvin Sinet, wrote a study in the 1980s. But that's it. Fischer faded.
He was more productive than he died in 1934, and he had written more than most of the usual suspects, Zora Neale Hurston, Langston Hughes, Connie Cullen. And I was trying to figure out, well, how did he get forgotten so quickly?
That's the question Kevin has been chasing. After finishing his second book, a biography of Philip Peyton, the real estate pioneer, Kevin finally turned to Fischer full time.
The Peyton biography came out in 2021. And probably right after that, I returned to Rudolf Fischer because I felt, okay, I think I'm ready now.
I didn't learn until later in the process that Kevin already had an agent and a publisher had expressed interest with a condition.
He said he wanted to see more what I can do. And so that's what these three chapters will be. And that's why I understand that I won't have a second chance to go to that place.
One shot. The publisher wanted to see if an academic could actually write a page-turner. Kevin had been through this before. A previous project about a Black Civil War correspondent had fallen apart. And Kevin believes the assumption behind the collapse was that academics can't write interesting narratives. This time, Kevin was determined to prove them wrong. He had the research. He had the agent. He had the subject. A man who, when asked how he wanted to be remembered, said something Kevin couldn't forget.
When he's asked how he wants to be viewed, he says he would like to be viewed as Harlem's interpreter.
Harlem's interpreter. Kevin is going to make sure the world remembers that. Katie Rose Quant is a journalist. She's written for The Nation, The Atlantic, and Slate. She's in the same CUNY biography and memoir program where Kate Culkin teaches. And when I first spoke to her in April 2025, she was pregnant with her third child. She's writing a group biography of five women.
There's five main subjects that I'm particularly seeking to follow. Jane Addams, and then Julia Lathrop, Florence Kelly, Alice Hamilton, and Grace Abbott.
If you don't know those names, that's kind of the point. These five women built the foundations of the American administrative state. Worker safety, food safety, child labor laws, and immigrant rights. They met at Hull House, Jane Addams' settlement house in Chicago, around the turn of the 20th century. And they spent the next several decades reshaping how the American government protects its citizens.
They definitely worked together throughout their lives, were very close professional relationships and also very close personal friends, lived together at, you know, earlier in their careers, and just this constant flow of communication and collaboration between them.
A network. This wasn't five random individuals who happened to work on similar issues. These were five friends who built something together. Katie Rose had been developing this project through the CUNY program for a while. She had done archival research, written sections for coursework, and worked through the ideas. But she didn't have a book deal. She didn't have an agent. She had a partial proposal and a deadline that had nothing to do with publishing.
I do have two young children. This will be my third kid. I have, my son will be four soon and my daughter will be two soon. So basically the whole time I've been like in this biography program at CUNY and working on this project, I've had little kids.
The baby was the deadline. Finish the proposal before the baby comes. Send it out and hope for the best.
It is my goal to have that in pretty shoppable shape by the time I have my baby in July. Oh, I'm due on July 22nd.
But getting an agent when you've never published a book? Katie Rose knew exactly what that looked like.
I also know from journalism how cold pitching a story, an article to a publication you've never worked with can just be a really difficult process. And I'm kind of assuming that these agents also get so many cold emails that I'm really not super optimistic about this as like a numbers game, but that's the work that I've been doing, and I'm going to be figuring it out as I go along.
Sarah had an agent who'd been with her since her 20s. Kevin had an agent who was shopping his chapters. Kate didn't need an agent. She went through a university press. But Katie Rose was starting from zero. And there was something else she told me that stuck with me for the entire 8 months of this project.
I mean, I just kind of feel like I am not a biographer because I haven't published a biography. And I know how hard and long the process of writing a book is. And I know how many times book proposals get rejected, and I know all the different challenges that people face, and I feel like that's all ahead of me.
I am not a biographer because I haven't published biography. Remember that. We're going to come back to it. So, four biographers, a comedian with a book deal, and 18,000 competitors. A professor about to publish a book she'll have to promote entirely on her own. A historian who's been thinking about his subject for almost 40 years and finally has a shot. And a journalist, pregnant with a proposal she hasn't sent out, and a question about whether she even gets to call herself a biographer. Over the next five episodes, you're going to follow all four of them from spring 2025 to January 2026. You'll hear Sarah figure out that research can become the world's most sophisticated form of procrastination. Kate will discover that her university press doesn't share sales numbers in the first year. You're going to hear Kevin find out that someone else is writing about Rudolf Fischer. And you're going to hear Katie Rose, 8 months later, answer that question, "Am I a biographer?" This is the real story of biographical work. Not the romance of dusty archives and eureka moments. It's the actual, unglamorous, stubborn, sometimes heartbreaking work of writing about someone else's life. Next time, the work. Sarah goes to Kentucky and falls in love with the research. Too in love. Kate's book comes out, and she gets on a 5:30 a.m. train to Concord to carry a sign in a parade. Kevin makes a discovery at Howard University, and Katie Rose tries to finish a proposal before the baby arrives. Four Paths, One Impossible Dream is a production of BioPodcast and Biographers International Organization. Ellie and Marie Fillengains created our theme music. Carolyn Van Putten is our assistant producer. Cherie Newman is our engineer. And Sonia Williams is our executive producer. I'm Jenny Skoog. Special thanks to Sarah Benincasa, Kate Culkin, Kevin McRuder, and Katie Rose Quant for letting me into their lives and their work. To learn more about bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org.